Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
From your perspective, it's like we've got this sort of fundamental thing about human beings, and then we've got the way that we constitute our politics. And the danger is that if our politics grow too tribal, they grow excessively tribal, right? Then we like lose the common wheel. We lose the sort of way of talking. And we start doing this thing that you said, you know, if Trump wants to talk to Kim Jong-un, then it's necessarily bad, even though I personally think, like, yeah, go talk to Kim Jong-un. But we all have that, right? Like, it's like, oh, if Trump says it, then it must be a bad idea kind of impulse.
But I think that's not just a random thing. I try to explain why at this particular moment we are in maybe more, I mean, okay, there was the Civil War and there have been these difficult moments, but that we are seeing tribalism taken over our political system in a way that we haven't seen in many generations.
Welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Have you noticed there's been a lot of talk recently about political tribalism? It's a term, I guess it's a term that's existed for a while. People talk about tribalism, but it's gotten really intense recently. It's entered into common usage, and you see it invoked all the time. And I have some really, really intensely, aggressively mixed feelings about it. Well, first, there are American Indians, indigenous and native peoples who don't like the term because the adjective tribal has to do with folks that come from those communities. And so to talk about it in a negative way seems to take away from an adjective that is about a very specific set of lived experiences. So there's that issue. But to me, the reason I feel torn about this term is that I'm both really sympathetic to a critique of political tribalism and also think it's used really imprecisely to paper over some really important differences in how people approach politics and what they fight about. So on one side, right, I get that people do rally around their side in ways that can be ugly and shut down the way people think about things. And it can make conversations in politics impossible to have, where people don't extend good faith, they don't extend any charitable readings of people on the other side, and we can't have any discussions about big issues the country faces. I get all that. That's true. I see it happen. I see that part of me kick into gear sometimes. I see it in viewers all the time. I see it on my Twitter at replies. I've saw it during the Democratic primary particularly, where people just were in one of two camps and they interpreted everything we did and the show did through those camps and had a hard time listening across the divide. At the same time, there's also the fact that people will use that term to critique kinds of politics that I think are really important. Like when people mobilize as a group to fight for something, you could call that, I guess, political tribalism. You could say, well, they're fighting for their group. They only care about, you know, their group of people with their complaints. Or you could call it, you know, politics. You could call it organizing. You could call it active struggle. And it's kind of in the eye of the beholder which of those two any given diagnosis of, quote, political tribalism is. Which brings me to Amy Chua. Amy Chua is a really interesting writer and thinker, law professor at Yale, who's got a new book out called Political Tribes, which is about, well, political tribalism. She's someone who first entered my radar screen years ago when she wrote this really fascinating book called World on Fire, which was about the ways in which globalization often incited or exacerbated ethnic tensions and racial tensions within countries. And she's also the one that wrote, you probably know this book. She wrote this this book called The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, which was a ginormous mega bestseller. It's been, you know, I think it's been a year on the bestseller list. It sold millions of copies. It was about kind of her mom, you know, driving her very hard and how hard she drove her kids. A celebration of something I think people come to see as a bad thing, which is obsessively achievement-oriented parenting. Let's call it that. So that's Amy Chua. So she's got this new book called Political Tribes. And it it kind of takes a side in that debate I was talking about, right? The ambiguity I have about this term and tribalism. But the thrust of the critique is that U.S. politics have fallen into this tribalist trap, and we're sinking into it, and it's breaking our politics. We need to get out of it. So I wanted to talk to her because I don't know if I buy it. But I don't not buy it. I have complicated feelings about it. And I thought, here's someone who I really respect, who's really smart, who's thought about this, who's thought about it in a lot of different, really interesting and fraught contexts, and who's written a book about it. And in some ways, this question about what's tribalism, what's sort of dangerous, bad in-group thinking, what's good group organizing, that's kind of at the center of all of our politics right now. And so I wanted to have a conversation and kind of work it out with her a bit about this topic, which is, what exactly do we mean when we talk about political tribes? I think I'm both attracted to and repulsed by the concept of tribalism, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. at one point, it feels really seductively explanatory, because it does feel like a lot of American politics is essentially some kind of in-group, out-group combat by other means. And then at the same time, I feel like the concept is really problematic for a lot of reasons. So I guess let me start with, like, what do you mean by tribes?
Well, there are lots of different ways that I use tribes. I mean, there are actual tribes like the Pashtun Afghan tribes. I actually am using it just in the sense of a very strong group identification, the kind of group identification where your identity is so bound up with it that you will basically defend the group and cling to the group no matter what, and you start to see everything through that group's lens.
So, like, the way that we think about it in geopolitics, right, yeah. or in history is, like, linguistic, ethnic, and religious cultural groups.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually am using the term much more broadly, right? Because we're all very tribal. Humans are very tribal. If you look at sports, that is a great example of tribalism. I mean, now you could say that that is cultural. And in fact, it's interesting because sports teams are often tied to hometowns mm-hmm. or cities. So there is, you can kind of link it back to ethnicity in an interesting way. The way I look at it is, yes, most tribes that I study, that I've studied for 20 years, are often ethnic or sectarian or religious. And so I'm exploring in this book the idea of almost like a more modern kind of tribe, which is a not ethnically based necessarily political tribe, but there are ethnic elements in the tribalism that we're seeing in the United States.
Well, that's right. So that's where it gets. So let's talk about sports, because sports are great example. Like, I always have this encounter where I'll be like, oh man, political Twitter's the worst. But then I'll, like, have any occasion to hop over into sports Twitter, and it's like, oh my God, what a nightmare. Like, you guys are arguing over who the best team is? Like, it's like all of the same modes of argument, of interaction, of like, all of a sudden they're there, but there's no actual, like, substantive or moral content.
Well, just think about it. Think about how, I don't know what your favorite sports team is. You know, in my family, it's the Yankees. And it just doesn't matter, right? Whatever the call is. And it's not just that you always think that the referee or the umpire said the wrong thing when it goes against your team. It's also this feeling that you start to feel like that your team's members are actually better people. And then you'll have, like, rivals, and you'll see a pitcher on the other side, and you're like, the way they look, the way they're, like, morally not as good. And it's
totally
absurd, because then you trade players and then they
right.
become on your team. But it's that level of almost, like, instinctive, and it's actually irrational. It affects people's logical powers.
Is there anything good about it, I guess, is my question.
Definitely. I mean, it ties into sort of identity politics. You know, there's so much simplistic us versus them. I'm not somebody that's against identity politics straight out. So I'm a very tribal person. I wrote the Tiger Mother book. And being
That book is tribal AF.
Yes, and I'm the daughter of ethnic Chinese immigrants. My parents taught me to have enormous pride, and that kind of pride in my ancestry was a kind of armor, psychological armor for me in a country where I experienced a lot of discrimination. So I not only get tribalism, I see a lot of its strengths and advantages. You could describe a movement like Black Lives Matter as, you know, in the same way. Like, it's a kind of a solidarity, a connection you feel.
Well, here, yep. let me stop you right yep. there, right? Because what ends up happening is, I want to approach this in a way where I talk about the critique I don't like.
Okay.
Okay? So here's what I don't like. I don't like it always feels to me that what ends up happening is when someone comes in and says, these are tribal politics there.
Okay.
Right? That, like, they have tacitly elevated themselves to some place where, like, they're in the view from nowhere.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
They're, like, floating above it, and all you messy little humans, like, are just fighting out tribal
stuff. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's actually kind of point, the main point that I'm making in my book, actually,
right.
Which is that I don't think anybody is above tribalism. In fact, the pool of people that I think you and I are probably in, Chris, that really liberal, multicultural, progressive people, we like to think of ourselves as anti-tribal, because if anything, we're probably cosmopolitan, tolerant, we want to see human beings as just human beings. One of my provocative lines in the book is that we're very tribal, we're very judgmental, and it's actually very hard to get into this tribe, because to have this kind of cosmopolitan,
totally.
You probably have traveled all kinds of places. I'm sure you did something like climb the Himalayas, and you know, and we are, you know, you go to schools where you meet people of lots of different ethnicities and religions, and a lot of people in America don't have that opportunity.
Oh, no, I totally agree. That part of the book I totally agree with. Like, there is in-group cohesion that's intense and powerful, with barriers to entry, with in-group solidarity among the kind of, like, liberal, open-minded, American, cosmopolitan, educated,
yes.
affluent class.
So here's the thing. If you want to know the simplest way for me to explain my position, I, and here you and I may differ. I love America. I think America is an exceptional
country. Wait, you say
country.
I don't love America?
Well, no, you do, but I have a line in my book where I say America is has been both exceptionally racist and exceptionally diverse, you know, in a very unique way. So I think this idea of America as a supergroup, as you know, it's a term I introduce. I think that we are pretty uniquely, at least among the major powers of the world, what I call a tribe of tribes. And that is, we both have a very strong, overarching collective identity, which we can come back to, is now, it's being shaken right now for good reason, I think, and some bad. But so we have a very strong, overarching collective identity, the kind of super tribe identity. But beneath that, we allow all kinds of other subgroup identities, tribal identities, if
right.
you want, to flourish, right? So you could even, this ties into intersectionality. And I think that's a good thing, that somebody can be, oh, I'm Irish American, I'm Libyan American, I'm Mormon American, and still be very patriotic at the
right,
same
sure.
time, those two things. So that's the best way when you say, is it good or bad? I think that the danger to America right now is if we devolve to a situation where we are only about our individual sub-tribes and we lose that thing that connects us all as Americans. And that is not to be romanticized. I mean, it's we're going through a correct moment of turmoil right now in figuring out how to define that collective identity. I think that's a healthy thing, but I think we need it. As somebody that studied countries that have literally fallen apart, like Libya and Syria and Iraq, I feel like a lot of elites and a lot of progressives and a lot of conservatives in this country don't realize that they're playing with fire. They're just like, they're so angry, rightfully, for good reasons, that they are just getting more. And here's the negative aspect of tribalism. They're just in their little individual tribes, becoming more and more exclusionary of other tribes and just losing any sense of having anything in common with people, for example, who either are of a different race or voted on the other political side or other divides.
So to complicate this picture, right? So one of the things, I think one of my reticences about the term tribe or tribalism, mm-hmm. right, is that it seems to sort of posit there's these groups that are all walking around in a similar plane, right? But like we know, and you would obviously say this, you talk about it in the book and you talk about it in your first book, which is fantastic, called World on Fire, which is published in 2003, there's hierarchies of dominance, right?
Absolutely.
So here's a great example, right?
Yeah.
And why I think this sort of, when we think about in terms of tribes, we can be led astray. You could look at the politics of the militarily occupied South of 1870
mm-hmm.
as tribal. And they were.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the sense that, like, all the black people voted for the Republican Party,
mm-hmm.
and basically all the white people, or all the white Southerners, voted for the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And they were tribal politics. But if you viewed it as, like, tribal politics, it was like, well, there's this one group over here and there's one group over there. Like, you're missing the picture, right?
Oh, yeah. I totally disagree with you. I agree with you about what you said, which is, I think it's getting a little bit tired, this kind of both-siderism. I don't think that's helpful at all. So here's where I agree with you. Of course they are not morally equivalent.
Right.
Of course the massive white supremacist, horrible, Nazi-inflicted big tribe was morally worse.
Right.
But I don't agree with you that it's not helpful to think of it in terms of tribes. I think it's a form of denial. I see it in my own students. It's like you can be part of a tribe that you're very, very proud of. You know, in fact, I've just had this discussion with a lot of my Native American students. They're like, we are objecting to the use of tribalism in a negative sense in the American polity because we love, we're very proud of our tribes. So there, I sort of got you, Chris, because they want to say that this is my tribe. I belong to the Choctaw or, you know.
Right.
So I think tribalism, it goes back to a kind of loyalty, but I think it actually explains a lot of things. So right now, if you were to ask about American politics right now, and I see it all the time, you know, including on your show, which is like one of my favorites, right?
You have good taste.
But I mean, it's like right now, I don't think if something comes out of the White House, our instinctive reaction for progressives is to just it's bad, it's wrong.
Right.
Whatever happened in Korea, whatever policy battle ran, and it doesn't really matter if 5 years ago it was your party that actually advocated it. You know, it doesn't really matter if actually just 3 weeks ago somebody said that. And that I really did not think is good for the country. I do not think we can't even have a normal conversation. We lose credibility.
All right. So I want to respond in two ways to that, right? So one, let's take that first part, which is what I'm hearing from you, and this is interesting. Right? Is that what I'm hearing from you is you're saying, look, this is a category about how people interact, and you are still sort of bringing this baggage about it as a judgment, right? So that if you say like newly freed slaves in the South are acting like in a tribal fashion, like that's pejorative, right? And what you're saying is like, no, it's just a descriptive fact about human beings collectively acting in a sort of group
identity. Yeah, and it's proven. I mean, most of this book actually just shows these actually rather frightening, but I think not controversial studies that human beings have to belong to a group. We're like our other primates. And then there are all these fascinating things that show how I love this one, that once we connect with a group, and that's why I like the word tribe too, because it's not any group. And I tried to explain this, as certain groups have more grip. Like
accountant, for instance, doesn't really work as a tribe.
The American Dental Association.
Right.
You might be a member of that group, but you're not going to kill and die for it. But other the kinds of groups that I'm interested in, and it used to not be political, Chris, that's my point.
Right.
But, you know, like ethnic or whatever, you know, village, the studies show that once you connect with a tribe in a certain way, then you actually start to interpret facts and studies and statistics to fit your tribe's worldview. And this is one of the most scary things. My colleague Dan Kahan does a lot of studies like this, because these studies also show that the smarter you are, that is, the better you are at math and numeracy, the better you are at manipulating facts to fit your, and that's something we need to deal with if we're going to make any kind of progress.
There's a great data point on this, which is that conservatives and Republicans with higher education degrees are more skeptical of climate change.
Oh my gosh.
So and
exactly.
Precisely because of that, right? Because the more educated you are, the more sort of resources you can devote to the process of reverse engineering your views, right?
Right.
And I don't want to say this is just a thing conservatives do. Like, I do this, you do this, we all do this.
Yeah.
And that brings to that sort of second point, right? So from your perspective, it's like we've got this sort of fundamental thing about human beings, and then we've got the way that we constitute our politics. And the danger is that if our politics grow too tribal, they grow excessively tribal, right? Then we like lose the common wheel. We'll lose the sort of way of talking. And we start doing this thing that you said, you know, if Trump wants to talk to Kim Jong-un, then it's necessarily bad, even though I personally think like, yeah, go talk to Kim Jong-un. Like, that's my belief. And it's a thing that like I patrol for a lot, like
you
on the
do.
Show, right?
You do. You do a really good job.
No, but it's like, but we all have that, right? Like, it's like, oh, if Trump says it, then it must be a bad idea kind of impulse.
But I think it's not just a random thing. I try to explain why at this particular moment we are in maybe more, I mean, okay, there was the Civil War and there have been these difficult moments, but that we are seeing tribalism taking over our political system in a way that we haven't seen in many generations. And it's really for two, like, these are documentable. Like, if you look at views on immigration, just even, I don't know, 7 years ago, 10 years ago, Democrats and Republicans had a lot more overlap. It was a lot of people in the middle, you know, actually a lot of Democrats and Republicans, same view. And if you look at it today, way more extreme. The Republicans are way more anti any form of immigration, legal or illegal, and Democrats are way more at the extreme. And now, I'm not saying that one could be better or worse. I mean, like, I'm a very pro-immigrant person.
Right.
I'm simply saying that it's not just me randomly using this catchy term tribalism. And the other thing, it does come back to race. As you know, for the first time in our history at the national level, whites are on the verge of losing their majority status in 20 years. And I think this is, it's no coincidence that our politics are getting more tribal.
Right. So there's two things happening. So we've got these tribes and we've got these in-groups and they, these identities that we move through and have, right? And so what you're putting your finger on there, and it's something that, a lot of people have been doing work on, right, which is that increasingly our political, ideological, or even partisan divisions are the overarching ones that are sort of dominating and controlling, and that other sort of like ethnic, religious identities are sort of all sorting in this way, right? So it used to be that like you would have like very religious white Christians who were Democrats and Republicans, right? But increasingly it's like, no, that's you're a Republican if you're a very religious white Christian.
Exactly. So it's a little bit more complicated because within, let's just take broadly progressives or broadly conservatives, there are all kinds of other hardening, smaller subgroup divisions that I also write about. You know, I think it's an interesting development, and I completely understand why. This is not even a critique, but we are at a moment where very few people are left standing, defending kind of group transcending. Identities. You know,
right.
On the left, I teach on a very liberal campus, and I support this. I understand why. It's really different than the civil rights era, you know, or even 30 years ago, even when President Obama was president, where there was a lot of idealistic, you know, let's transcend skin color. Right now, on college campuses and among progressives generally, group blindness is the ultimate sin. I mean, if you, it's really, and it's epistemological. It's very different. It's you're not a woman. You can't speak for me. You can't understand. The barriers are harder. It's less porous. Even the whole idea of cultural appropriation. You know, when I was just like 30 years ago, all the hip multicultural people in Berkeley where I grew up, it's like they wanted to wear cornrows and wear a sari and be doing, you know, serving. And now all of these things would now be cultural appropriation.
Although I got to come down on the side of the critique there. Because like,
well, it depends what. I mean, it depends.
That's true. Although the white people walking around Berkeley in cornrows were kind of whack.
You know that. I agree with you. But how about food? How about food?
Right. No, right? I get
to possess certain foods. Like it's like you can't. I think.
No,
it's,
I remember yeah. I get these controversies. But I think that, here's the thing though. Like I just feel like the lens here, that lens of like a campus, right? I guess I'm not convinced that the same thing is happening everywhere else.
Oh. I am. I think you're right. It's an exaggerated and
like,
concentrated form.
I was at Brown.
But it's a while ago. It's different.
No, but I'm saying it was the same thing in some ways. Like, I mean, it was we had massive controversy around exactly these sort of things about who can speak and who can't speak, about identity, about, you know, like there were really nasty, intense fights about on this same terrain back
then. Well, so I love Yale and I actually am the affinity group supporter. Like I have Balsa, the black students over to my house. Then I have the Asian students. Then I have the outlaws.
Right.
Okay. And I've tried a couple times to say, let's do a joint thing and have a debate or something like that. You know, like the conservative students and the Asians or whatever. It's not working. It's post-election, and I understand it. People are still very angry. I tried to do this in my class, and I think it was a big success. But afterwards, Chris, it was so hot. People were like, we need to open the windows.
Okay, but here's the thing.
It was hard.
But this is getting the bedrock because it's like, I just feel, why am I like, there's something I want to argue with you here.
Yeah.
And it's two things because like, I hear what you're saying. And I, in another conversation, like faced with another person could make your argument, right? But I'm going to stay on my side for a second, which is this. Like, there's two issues I have, I think, with that general framework. One is, like, it always feels slightly ahistorical to me in the sense of, like, every time that I've ever dived into a particular political moment or even a movement, like, it's crazily factional as hell and crazily polarized as hell and crazily, like, identity-obsessed as hell. Like, if you read a biography of Fiala LaGuardia, and they're like fighting over like how many Greeks they put in the frickin' tax commission board. Like,
so you know, Chris, I don't think we actually disagree. I might be describing it as if in a critical way, but part of it I think is just this is the healthy result of the massive demographic changes we're seeing.
Right.
So I totally agree that America has always been just as tribal. It's just that we, for most of our history, had one massive tribe. Whites, I mean, and of course there were divisions with them, but basically whites, economically, politically, culturally, militarily dominant, and all these other smaller tribes just squashed, right? And so, but what I mean—
And your argument in the book is that that provides a kind of stability.
It does, and it's a very invidious kind of stability. So I wonder what you think about this. Like, we have lots of retreats now, which I support. You know, so Asian students go off to their retreat. You know, we put them up in like a nice hotel. The Balsa students go off to Maine and do something cool. The Federal Society, they all go. Now, I like that. I understand. It's a form of solidarity that I wish I had had when I was feeling lonely, only Chinese kid in Indiana. So I support that. But I still have this kind of romantic idea that I feel like sometimes I really worry that I don't think we're getting the best conversations. You know, I think that we are starting to caricature and have cartoon figures of the other side, you know, now with Asian Americans in affirmative action. And then I know Balsa has this view, and there are a lot of increasing zero-sum competition where people on opposite sides.
Right.
And I feel like they're difficult. These are difficult. I don't even know my own view, but we need to talk about them, you know, and as opposed to just kind of oh, come on, you poor whites, you dare say that you're actually anywhere close to as oppressed as we were. Like, I actually think there's probably a right answer to that. Yes, that's, you know, but right. I don't think it should be sealed off, people angry. I think it's better to talk about that. That's all I mean.
I mean, there's like a discourse problem, which I agree. And I'm someone that likes conversations. So I like to talk to different people with different views. But I guess I just wonder, like, what's the version of the thing that isn't this?
Well, okay, let me give you a good example. Okay, immigration, something that I'm sure we're on the same page. My second book was all about how immigration is the key to everything great about America. Right. So you kind of know where I come out on this. This use of the word racist is appropriate in many, many contexts. I get uncomfortable because I've been studying prejudice for 20 years when it's applied to, like, very large numbers, like, say, 60 million people.
Right.
You know, so immigration, if you remember the studies that I cite of Paul Bloom, they show that it's that newborns are not born racist. That's the good news.
Right.
But as of 3 months, Asian babies prefer Asian faces. White babies prefer white faces. Ethiopian babies prefer Ethiopian faces. And for obvious reasons, right. You can imagine why the mother looks like that. So I think right now with the immigration debate, when you say it's almost like you're saying, how can things possibly get better? And I think they can be better. And I think tribalism comes into this. It makes sense to me that right now in the spheres that you and I occupy, anybody that is just not really pro-immigration, just generally, is a racist, xenophobe, Islamophobe. Okay, and I think there's something deeply wrong with this discussion, because imagine if China, okay, learned that in 20 years it was going to transition to majority white. Or the country of Nigeria.
Or just not even Han Chinese. They'd flip the frick out.
Exactly. But I'm just trying to move us away from the United States. Okay,
right.
Let's say Nigeria discovered that in 20 years it was going to become white. You know what? I think a majority of the people there would be anxious. Is that racist? Maybe. Maybe we're all, you know, they're like, wait, this is not the country that we knew. They're resistant to that. And I feel that we can do better with this conversation. We need to have some conversations about limits and what and roles. And otherwise, we're at this travesty where we are now about the wall, that we are at a frightful, terrifying situation where we're losing what America is going to be. And again, I don't know, this is maybe me being different than you. I feel like, whereas you're pushing me on this term tribalism, I actually think it's a better frame, you know, because I don't think we're doing very well with the categories we have right now,
right. I mean,
which is like white supremacists versus all the really good people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I agree with. Right. But so the immigration. So that example is a really interesting one, as you have written about. And as you know, like China's like a super racist place where
people
essentially the power of the state is wielded to like ensure Han Chinese dominance.
Yep.
And, you know, there's like this sort of putative multiculturalism that is.
Right.
You know, it's tokenism.
It's not real.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in all cases, right, like there's both difference, which is like, oh, you're different. But then there's like the machinery of dominance, right?
Yes. Okay.
And the machinery of dominance, it's like the question, there's this question about like, which are you going to kind of foreground or what are you going to think about, right? And like the way that I think about these is in the context of the machinery of dominance more than like.
Got it. Okay. But here's what I think. I think that you are bearing something in there. You think that the world, in specifically America, would be better to be not an all white. You welcome the idea that we're going to be multicultural and be different skin colors. And you see that and look at me. Of course, I have that view. You know, my kids are like half Jewish, whatever. You know,
and
all my
me,
students.
Let me just say, that's tribal for me. I grew up in New York City. Like
yes.
That's part of my identity. Is like I'm a New Yorker, and New Yorkers are people who are cosmopolitan and grow
so
up around other.
So you beat me to
different.
It. Right. So you beat me to it, and in a way you could have. But
sorry.
No, but that's a great point. But my idea is okay. So let's say you think that's like a better tribal outlook. You know, again, how do we get there for America? How do we get there? And I don't think that right now the way that your side, our side, is doing it is the best way, which is, I mean, just take a human react. Like, okay, you're very sensitive. If somebody were to call you and say, oh, Chris, you're a racist. What you said this night was racist. I know how you'd respond. You'd listen. You'd be very, very open. And then you would, but you know what? That's because of who you are, how you're raised. Plus, you're really famous and you have a show.
Right.
Like, if you're somebody that's in the middle, just somebody that is in the middle of the country and somebody says, you know what? You are a racist bigot. How do you think they're going to respond? Do you think they're going to be like, oh my God, you're right.
No,
let me join
totally.
The other political side. I don't think we're advancing ourselves to your tribe's vision the way we're discussing things right now.
But that is, but I will totally agree with that, right? So like the idea of like you're racist as a conversational part is like not, it's often not super effective. I do think there's like a really useful role that like shame and taboo
absolutely
plays.
And for
like,
certain things, many
yeah,
things,
right, right.
So and for I, many people.
But
yeah.
there's this sense, and this is a critique I think that you have, and I've said others that like that the boundaries that keep creeping outward, right? So like, and particularly the application of this word white supremacy. So like, let me totally agree with you on that, right? But I also feel like there's a little bit of a sliding happening there, which is like that's a question of how to talk to people, mm-hmm. right? About like what the facts of the matter are.
Yeah.
Which are, that's fine. Those are two different discussions. But it's like, for instance, the Confederate flag, which is a great example of this. Like, yeah, like people get their back up about the Confederate flag. And like, I get that. I can have some empathy to that. Like, they feel a tribal affiliation to it. It's a flag of slavery and treason that should be burned forevermore everywhere.
I think we agree on that one. I mean, I think
But that's like a big one.
It's a huge one, but it's also how big? How big? The studies that I like best in my book are the ones that show that if you pull people out of their tribal context, right, and say, don't talk about politics, but talk about like dogs or food or something. My favorite example is the integration of the U.S. military in the 50s. It was as bad a moment as today. People were like, no, we can't integrate it. You know, it's going to be, and it was 90% public opinion against integrating the military. Well, they did it. And afterwards, they found that the integrated troops were as effective or more effective than the all-white ones. And then they conducted all these surveys and studies. And what they found is, I think, the most beautiful message, right? Which is that people said, and now this isn't just black and white, although that was part of it. But Italian Americans had never met like Swedish Americans. So
totally,
the accents. But people are like, if you are in this dangerous situation, you miss home, you feel terrible, your lives are in, you're putting your lives in somebody else's hand. It really doesn't matter what accent they have or what the color of their skin is. So I'm an idealist that way. I feel like people, that this is really what America can be, you know. So yes, the Confederate flag, that's an easy one. But how about somebody that's in the middle of Iowa who is like a 50-year-old mother of six who's adopted a couple of African orphans? I've actually talked, you know, they voted for Trump.
Right.
What do you do with that, right? You could say, oh, the fact that you could vote for a racist means that you first admit that you're a little bit more racist.
Right.
That's what a lot of people want to do. Is like, I'm willing to be open, but first admit that you did something really terrible doing that, you know? And we can have a debate about that. I just don't think that that's necessarily the most way. And I think so back to this discussion of, I think the Confederate flag is almost too easy an example. And if you were to show me, prove to me that 65 million people actually feel that way, then I would probably start to come over to your side. But I don't think that.
To me, part of what the issue is, we don't actually have like collective activities. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like the conversation's one thing. You talk to the Iowa mom or whatever, but like, it's also just like we don't do stuff with each other,
totally.
Which and, to me feels like a bigger,
it is,
and bigger problem.
Right. And so maybe that's, I mean, I that's where I end the book. I really think that this lack of upward mobility and a lack of geographical mobility, again, these are documentable.
Totally.
This is not just, you know.
Yeah, no, those.
And it used to be that somebody in the middle of the country, you know, it could even have been your parents or something. You start with no money and then you go to public school, public college. And you can make it to one of the coasts. and you could go back and forth and you could rise and fall. Right now, it's so rigid. I mean, nobody can afford to live in New York City or Silicon Valley anymore. Right. And if you think about all the people that you hang out with and the values that they have, maybe we're saying the same thing, that I think that if there were more exposure, and there are studies, I want to be clear, there are studies that show that just straight out exposure is not enough. Okay, you could put lots
in
of people.
In fact, it often backfires.
It often backfires. But but even more important studies show that if you go one step further, and just maybe it's what you were saying, communal interaction,
right,
real human interaction for a relatively sustained time, people are good. They're better. I mean, it's like what happened in your neighborhood in New York can happen elsewhere in the country. But right now, there are these almost like structural barriers preventing that from happening.
That relates to a really important point, too, about this kind of like, I think, like sort of blinkered like economic anxiety versus bigotry, racial animus thing about the 2016 election, which, of course, is kind of the subtext for all of this,
yes,
right? Like everyone's trying to figure out blah, blah, blah. The thing to think about is like, okay, this is a true thing about human beings in any society, right? Like tribalism, factionalism, groups fighting each other, dominance hierarchies. Different environments like exacerbate or reduce the heat.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You know, you talk about it in the Iraq chapter, and there's a whole part of the book that's sort of about U.S. foreign policy. There's a way that people will like dismiss, you know, some fight that's happening in Iraq as like tribal or like the Sunni and the Shia, and they've hated each other for thousands of years. Like, well, yeah, but like if you came to the U.S. and took away the United States government, like guess what people would start doing to each other in the streets,
Our
right?
institutions are so important.
That's exactly right. Like, the point there is that better institutions that provide better governance and better outcomes for a bunch of people is going to lower the temperature of the conflict.
I really, really agree with you. But here's where, in a rare case of me being more pessimistic than you, I think it goes back to what you said, that we keep forgetting how invidiously stable the situation was in this country of having a white majority so hegemonic for so long.
Right.
You know, I mean, those institutions are being tested right now, and it's easy just to point the finger and say, oh, my God. But another thing we could say is that we romanticize some of our institutions and democracy. Like, the fact is that for most of our country's history, we actually didn't let lots of people vote.
Right.
Right. So we went abroad and told everybody to democratize and have the elections as fast as possible. And in a sense, we're getting a taste of our own medicine right now. We're seeing what happens when you have elections under certain conditions. And then when you see the rise of demagogues and which way people will go. But like right now, I think one thing that I'm seeing among my progressive friends is something that I've seen in Latin American countries, which is after the Trump election, many of my progressive friends are so horrified by this outcome that you're seeing what I describe as an elite backlash against the popular side of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's never described that way. In fact, what people are saying is I'm fighting authoritarianism. But I want to call people out on that. An elite backlash. Okay, so on the conservative side, it's easy to call out. That's, you know, piece of cake. It's like the white elites who don't want the minority-majority places. We're going to do voter suppression. We don't want that. But on the left, I think we have to be careful. I've seen it's usually cocktails, dinner parties, after the third drink, somebody says, you know, something has just happened where something's come out of the White House and people are still supporting it and it's ghastly. And people start talking about maybe we should have like knowledge requirements for voting, or maybe we should have IQ requirements. This is stuff that the Latin American elites have been talking about for 100 years.
Right.
Americans have been so romantic about it, partly because we don't realize that we excluded all these poor people. But when they talked about democracy in a lot of countries from Bolivia to Venezuela, you know, they were talking about democracy with a lot of minority protections,
right,
a lot of property protections, a lot of rule of law protections, which I favor completely. But at some point, democracy's got to include a popular side to it. Otherwise, you just have crony capitalism.
There is, I will 100% agree with you, that there is a vein of thinking among certain folks post-election that is dangerously anti-democratic and dangerously contemptuous of fellow citizens, right? That, like, if these idiots could deliver us into this, I think it's important to segregate that from, like, a kind of elite opinion from people who are like, well, my mom was just deported. And, like, it's like,
yes,
I'm not, you know, you get,
of course,
like, I'm not going to question anyone's anger about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. And I think, look, one of the problems to me about the kind of current way that the country operates, right, is that in a weird way, it's like when you think about these political tribes, one of those tribes, which is the sort of broadly center left, right, has like outsized cultural power and control. Like, again, I'm not saying these people are leftists or even liberals, but like, if you say, like, how many Trump voters are there in like every top 20 TV show showrunner's office? How many Trump voters are there in every, you know, like, just go across these areas? Yeah. Very few. I mean, I just think that's probably an empirical truth.
It's truth. Right? I've shown it. Yeah.
So it's like, there's this huge cultural control in the hands of one tribe.
Yeah.
And then the other tribe, right? It's conservatives, whatever. They feel persecuted because they're like, well, I look out and there's all this control. But they have like unrivaled political control at the moment, right? It's like total control of government, control of 30 state houses. So it's like, and each side, I think, on that divide looks at the other's power and says, like, you have all the power and I'm.
And it's actually a pretty frightening situation if you look at what's happened across the world in other contexts, because when you get this kind of a situation, I haven't really found a happy ending. And that's why I kind of wrote the book, because I think that we don't have to be that way. It's a construction. It's a construction. And this is why I go back to your first question. I think the tribalism thing is actually identifying something important, because we are aggregating a lot of people on the other side that are not exactly all in one tribe. They do it to us even more. Or, you know, I mean, you should see, like,
right,
what
of course,
people
like,
say.
Across the divide, they all look the same. But, like, if you're in the group, right? Like, I mean, like, good God, political and factional disputes. I mean, the amount of fighting that goes on, but on very narrow grounds, right? Like, and this is true. It's true if you are a member of, like, an evangelical church. Like, there's this wing that wants this kind of thing, you know.
Right. But, I mean, if you hear, like, how Fox News describes people, like, you know, progressive, it's a complete caricature. And you only have to know that the 60 million people who are described like that are not all like that. There are a million different stories. But I think it's the same thing on the other side. So you asked such a good question at the beginning, because I know that I'm mixed about this, too. I think that tribalism has its dangers. I think that it can also be very, very powerful, and it's also unavoidable in some ways. But I think it has to be managed. And I think that our institutions are the, you know, people often ask me, are there any models you've studied other countries that could help us get out of this political tribalism? And I hate to sound so rah right here, but we are the model. I think we have the best formula and apparatus. We're either messing it up, or it's under attack from truly dangerous elements. That's happening too. So, you know, we have to stand up for the rule of law. But I think we have to get back to these basic apparatus things. And I think the tribalism really is undermining that on both sides. I really do.
Look, no one has ever, I mean, the thing I always think, right, is like a truly and genuinely multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy functioning free of ethnic and racial hierarchy, like, has not been built yet.
Never. It's
like, that's the thing America's we're trying to build. That's the project.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? I think the most inspiring thing I find is when you hear immigrants who love this country. You know, like, it's really interesting. I have a student quoted extensively in my book, but, you know, his parents are poor Mexican-American immigrants. They love the Constitution.
Totally.
They love these principles. They cannot believe it, you know, or people who just have come from Nepal or something.
To me, it's like, if you keep in mind that we're trying to build a thing no one's built before, and it's really hard to do.
You see that I end on Langston Hughes' poem, which is like the most beautiful poem. It's like it's really about America will be. It's like, you know, America was never America to me. Are you kidding? You know, it's the idea. But he's the one that says, but there's one thing I know, America will be. So it captures it perfectly.
All right. Amy Chiu is a professor of law at Yale. She is author of the new book, Political Tribes. And her first book, which I read and loved when it first came out, called World on Fire, which has some of these themes as well. Amy, it was great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Why Is This Happening? Is presented by MSNBC and NBC News Think, produced by the All In team, with music by Eddie Cooper. Hear more from Amy by reading her new Think piece at NBCNews.com/Why Is This Happening.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.